This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner. It's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here. With me on one continent is David Canfield.
Hi, Katie.
And over across the seas in Europe and Cannes specifically, still, we have Richard Lawson.
Bonsoir.
And Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
Richard and Rebecca, thank you for making the time to talk to us in your busy Cannes schedule. It has been a busy, really exciting Cannes for those of us watching from a distance. So we're going to catch up with you guys on all the highlights of the festival, which is still ongoing. We still have no awards. There's lots of festival yet to go, but lots to discuss. But before any of that, I want to talk to David about this great piece that he published this week. David, you've been looking into for months, really, a conversation we've had internally many times about what do we do about the fact that all of these major awards are very rigidly divided by gender and the world increasingly is not. And there are a lot of stars in Hollywood who are kind of slowly starting to speak up about that. A lot of younger stars, kind of in keeping with trends in general. And you talked to a lot of them for this piece. You didn't solve the issue yet, but I think the conversation that happened in that piece is really gratifying to read. And I think it was gratifying for you to report as well.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the kind words. And it was, it's not an issue that I see the same way as I did when I went into reporting the piece, mainly because I talked to a range of actors, people who've been in this industry for a long time, people who have just experienced their breakouts, and they've all communicated roughly the same thing, which is that this system is not for them. Mm-hmm. And whatever change can happen that is most amenable for the Academy, most doable for these various awards bodies, it doesn't really matter to them until they feel like they can be a part of the system in a way that doesn't essentially force them to choose a gender between mm-hmm. actor and actress. Because while actor is a historically non-gendered term, it is a gendered term now in the way that these award shows use it. And that's just pretty undeniable. I spoke with a couple actors who have chosen to no longer submit for awards consideration. One of the more interesting stories for me is Asia Kate Dillon. They were the first non-binary actor ever on a primetime show in a regular part for Showtime's Billions. When they joined that cast, they submitted as a supporting actor. They defended it as best they could in a variety piece, I believe. And now they regret doing that. And they were in Macbeth, the Broadway show with Daniel Craig and Ruth Negga. They did not submit to the Tonys that year. They are not submitting to the Emmys anymore, as far as I'm aware, for Billions, because they believe that this is a system that needs to change. And until then, they don't feel welcome in it. And then I also spoke with Bella Ramsey, who is the breakout star of The Last of Us. They now use they, them pronouns. And they are submitting as an actress. They had a lot of tough conversations with their team, with the show's showrunner, Craig Mazin. And they determined that while they feel like they are not welcome in either category and taking an actress label particularly is not one that they would assume for themselves, they don't want to feel like non-binary actors can't be recognized. And so it's this impossible negotiation that each of these actors are facing of like, do I make this kind of personal sacrifice in order to, you know, throw my hat in the ring? You know, Bella Ramsey gave one of the most acclaimed performances of the year this Emmy season. And I think that there is a fair point to be made of, well, it's not fair that I have to do this, but it's also not fair that I can't be considered. So that's a long way of saying that this is a really complicated issue. And the goal was really to just highlight these stories and where these actors find themselves right now.
Yeah, not just to throw their hat in the ring to be personally considered, but to represent other people. I mean, the power representation is something we talk about every year at the Oscars and so many other award shows. And non-binary people continue to be not especially visible in Hollywood. And Hollywood has a hard time representing anyone outside of the straight white male norm. So you really see the power and the pressure put on people like Bella Ramsey to stand up and be visible and represent a community, but then have to shove themselves into a category as a result. It's an impossible situation, like you said.
Yeah, and one theme that came across was this isn't exactly a conversation that anybody wants to be having. Some of these actors feel really strongly about having it and about advocating for non-binary talent, non-binary recognition. But, you know, I spoke with Justin David Sullivan, who is a breakout star of the Broadway musical and Juliet, and they decided not to submit. It was reported in the New York Times and it became this huge story. And, you know, this is an actor who'd never been on Broadway before. They had no real public profile to speak of and were really overwhelmed and they said scared by the attention they got, the pushback they got, just by making a kind of private decision that then blew up. And they talked about growing up as a theater kid, the dream from when you're on your first show is to be a Tony nominee someday. And it's not something that they feel happy about, but it is what they feel they have to do for themselves.
It's interesting, David, because I think, you know, I think about this with representation all the time, like putting all the responsibility and the burden on the people who are fighting for this rather than the organizations like moving forward with change is just so frustrating. And I know in your piece, you mentioned that, you know, the TV Academy and the Tonys and they're all like assessing it. But did you get any feel as to like if there's going to be movement soon? It just feels like this issue has been building and building.
Yeah, there's on the one hand, it feels like some of these shows are a little bit intractable and they don't really have the ability right now to even speak on what they can do to solve this issue because it is a complex issue. And we can get into some of the problems with finding an easy solution. But there is a sense that there is some inevitability to having to answer for this and having to adjust this. I honestly was a bit surprised by how little headway I was able to make with the organizations themselves. The Television Academy particularly, you know, released a statement to me that they'd released before, essentially emphasizing that performers can adjust the language on their trophy or nomination certificate from actor or actress to performer. And they said that there's no gender requirement for eligibility. And actually, you know, pass this along to a couple of the performers I spoke with. And Asia Kate Dillon said, that is an admission that these categories are completely arbitrary.
It's almost like gender is a construct.
You know, I putting on my objective reporter hat, but I do agree with that. I think that it's really impossible to say that you have an actress and actor category, and yet there's no gender requirement here. I mean, obviously, that's what it's there for. And so I did just respond to the Academy with this kind of point that a couple of the actors had made, and they just said the statement stands as is. So there's not really a willingness at this point to, at least on the record, engage with these debates. But there's no question that this is a trend that's only going to accelerate. And I just don't see how they're going to be able to proceed as is, especially as other smaller award shows are leaping ahead of them in terms of change.
We just need to see what that change looks like, though. You know, like the Gotham Awards, was it 2 years ago, did the first their first non-gendered. And wouldn't you know, there happened to be a tie and it one cis man won and one cis woman won. The fear has been if you go genderless or all gender in the acting categories, you're giving out fewer awards per night about the ones that people care about, you know, and that Daniel Day-Lewis beats Meryl Streep every time, you know. Yep. And I'm curious, David, in your reporting, like, did anything you learned or anything that someone said to you change any of those fears? You know, obviously we want to include as many people as we can, but the tendency in Hollywood is still to think of men, cis men, being the serious actors, and then, oh yeah, you know, like that actress was good too. What does the future look like in terms of that?
I don't know that those fears were allayed. A number of people pointed to this past Oscar season and basically were unanimous that it would have been Cate Blanchett and Michelle Yeoh, if it were two, and that they were the two strongest lead performance contenders.
That's such a fun Oscars to imagine, though. I'm just going to linger in that for a while.
Yes. But there's also the acknowledgement that that was a pretty unusual case. And the case of Everything Everywhere All at Once generally was a groundbreaking, unusual case. For me, it was more when this sentiment was presented to non-binary actors, it's like, well, that's not our problem. And unfortunately, whatever limitations the industry has in terms of representing women, let alone queer people, that's on the industry. And if anything, it's a wake-up call that the industry needs to change in the same way that, you know, Oscar So White was. And when you get into this question of quotas and making sure it's an equal balance, you might be presenting a false image of where the industry's at anyway. I personally do think it's a real concern, and the Academy especially does not want to suddenly ice out the majority of women in acting categories simply because this is a change they have to make. And that's a really real fear. The other really important element here, to your point, Richard, about, you know, the acting categories being the most popular, is the Oscars are really focused on staying on track after getting back on track last year, you know, to what people perceived. And that means not rocking the boat. And so that's a big challenge, is with award shows in such a precarious position to begin with, they're really just looking to make moves that are the safest and most clean to keep enough viewers in the tent, keep enough people happy, keep the industry happy, because the Oscars had been dealing with so much controversy that, you know, even just getting back to basics was considered a big success.
I mean, Rebecca, you do the most reporting among us about inside the Academy, and we were kind of following the social media guidelines that they released after the two Leslie scandal, and they were, you know, extensive but not groundbreaking in some way. I mean, what is your sense of willingness within the Academy to push the envelope in this direction at all?
Well, we did was it a year ago? There was a sort of a press Q&A with Bill Kramer, and someone did ask about this, and he said it wasn't something that was a priority to look at right now. But I would say in the last year, the conversation around this has increased tremendously since then. So I would sense that they are looking at it, but obviously they felt like clearing up the campaign rules was a more urgent issue. It just feels like change is slow with this group and complicated because, yeah, the question is, when you're looking at this big of a voting body, what do you do with these categories? You create a new category if you're combining performers into one. The categories for the Oscars they don't switch around as much as you see like with the Emmys and stuff. So
if they could do song score for like 4 years in the 90s, they can figure this out.
And if they so easily, took mixing and sound editing and sound mixing and just combine them, it's like,
I don't know. I feel like in the sound branch, that took some doing. Again, these things move slow.
That's true.
They move very slow.
Yeah, but the actors branch is the biggest branch. And, you know, I think if a lot of the actors are sort of paying attention to this, even if it isn't an issue that directly affects them, you know, I think they can be a really loud voice.
There's an opportunity to game this out a little bit too, because you can't just drop two categories without compensating in some way. So the Spirits instituted a breakthrough performance award that Stephanie Hsu won.
So the Spirits now have three acting categories as opposed to they once had four.
And they also recently instituted television, which I think helped them, you know, compensate for that loss a little bit, because they have big, you know, Quinta Brunson winning on the TV side is a notable moment for them as well. You can think about, you know, genre, or LAFCA still honors two per category, even if it's genderless and there's only two categories. So there's a lot of different ways they could go about it. There's ensemble prizes that you could look into. So it's interesting to think about the fact that for the Academy to do this, they would have to go a lot further than they usually do in compensating. And that would mean pretty radically altering the shape of their most popular awards, which, it's a big thing. They don't make changes very easily. And I think that makes it both more exciting and more unlikely that we're going to see any change from them in the next few years. The shows that I would really look to more imminently, in whispers, the expectation is that the Tony Awards are going to make a change within the next few years, if not next year. That just seems to be where the wind is blowing for that particular awards show. And the SAG Awards. The SAG Awards are in a really tough spot right now because they call their categories male actor in a leading role or whatever and female actor. And you cannot even do the TV Academy thing of claiming it's genderless, even if it's not. You know, it's quite literally in the description of the category. So they're going to have to make some adjustments. And I don't know that simply making it actor and actress will be viable given the climate. So they're probably going to have to do something. I'm just not sure what.
Yeah, they're about to go on. Oh, they might go on strike too. Just imagine a really big year for SAG, a strike and some awards changes. Yeah. I think it was Liv Houston in your piece who decided not to submit for Emmy consideration for Yellowjackets. So it was just basically like, reinvent it. Like, there's not a limit to it. And that kind of expansive thinking is something that awards bodies in particular have really lacked over the years. But I think that really helped me rethink, because I have an attachment, I think I've said on the podcast before, like, I like the long ribbon of history of best actress, and like the idea that Bette Davis won the same statue that Michelle Yeoh won, but it's not as important as people. And I think that's something you said, David, too, like, not that you didn't know that before reporting this piece, but that, like, recognizing the humanity of people who are in this industry is more important than tradition and history. And I think there's a way to learn that for everybody else too.
Yeah, and everyone on this podcast especially loves tradition history with these shows. So it's not a realization I come to lightly or that doesn't feel sort of strange, maybe. But yeah, if you acknowledge the existence of non-binary people in your favorite shows and movies, walking amongst you, in your family, et cetera, then in turn you have to acknowledge that this is not a system that is workable for them, and that that's a problem because these are people who are in this industry, who are out there. And how you reconcile those two things, I'm not quite sure without overhauling these categories in some way, come whatever consequence related to ratings or prestige, you know, quote unquote, because obviously that's partly a made up word in this context. Whatever may come, that feels like the biggest issue to me and the one that will ultimately, however long it takes, win the day.
Do any of us feel like we have a good idea for what the Oscars specifically should do? Because that to me feels like the hardest one to solve, maybe just because I care about the Oscars the most.
Well, not to segue too hard, but at Cannes, when they do the awards show, they have first, second, and third prize. So if you want to give out more acting prizes but keep it non-gendered, let's have first, second, and third prize in lead actor and first, second, and third in supporting. That's six awards.
Yeah,
do people really want second and third, Richard, in Hollywood?
If you nominate 10 people for each category, yeah, your top three.
I personally would love to see Cate Blanchett accept second prize. That would really be the highlight of the show for me.
Well, isn't that always our dream, is to see the tallies of Oscar? Like, I keep thinking maybe when the Oscars turn 100, they'll let us see the, like, vote tallies from the 20s or something, just to know. That would be
80-year gap,
Yeah, everyone involved is dead, and then you can finally release the tallies.
This was more off the record, but someone presented an interesting kind of idea for me. The general response to the Spirit Awards and the way that was handed out, I don't think was too great, at least within the industry, but they basically said, nominate 10 lead actors, lead performers, 10 supporting performers, have the voting go 10 and 10, give wins out to, you know, top two each win, and then present those four in batches of five nominees and just randomly, you know, distribute them in the show. And so it would be not a lot of difference to the viewer necessarily, which is an interesting idea. But it's obviously not the same thing, but it does solve to some extent the disruption factor, I suppose.
I mean, we know these award shows want as many stars as humanly possible in those rooms for people to tune in. So it feels like there is an opportunity to somehow craft the categories so there's actually more stars nominated and in the room. And then you also think about, like, we all have people that we wish had been nominated. Maybe they were from a small indie or a film that wasn't seen. Like, maybe there is a way to have a breakthrough character in indie film acting. I don't know what it would be, but to give a chance to actors whose films didn't have the same opportunity. I don't know what the answer to that is. It's a hard question. I mean, we're not denying that. That's for sure.
And the Oscar for best actor in a movie no one saw goes to?
To Andrew Riseborough.
Yeah, and then you have best actor in a movie everyone saw.
And then Tom Cruise. Wins once again.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to hear from our listeners about their ideas for solving this. I think we all know that it will be a while before the Oscars get somewhere. And it would be interesting if by the time the Oscars are really ready to make this change, there's more of a consensus about what could happen. I think that would maybe help them feel pushed in the direction. Because right now, like, everyone's got some ideas, but there's no, like, guys, just do this thing. So, yeah, if you want to be the one to solve it, email us. I would love to hear about it.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Okay, Richard, you mentioned Cannes Awards earlier in the show. We're not at the awards yet. Will you still be in town when the awards get handed out, or will you guys both be gone by then?
We'll both be gone. I've never been in town for the awards, which is a shame because apparently it is kind of a fun evening. But there's certainly been a lot of chatter leading up to those awards, which has been interesting.
Well, as of when we are recording, which is on Tuesday, there are still some major premieres left to happen. But all right, Richard and Rebecca, what's going to win the Palm?
Well, everyone seems to think that there are two no-brainers in terms of the big Cannes Awards. One, unfortunately, is a movie that Rebecca and I both have not seen because of scheduling problems, and that would be actress Sandra Hüller for a film called Anatomy of a Fall, which is kind of a French legal thriller. People really liked it. It sounds very entertaining. It was described to me as prestige HBO kind of thing. So people are thinking she's going to win Best Actress. In The Palme d'Or, Sandra Hüller is in a second movie called The Zone of Interest from Jonathan Glazer, which is a very harrowing, high-style drama about the Holocaust that is really the movie in competition that has blown most people away this year. Ahem, ahem, Rebecca.
we'll get there, Rebecca. We'll get there.
And so people seem to think that that is going to win. And so Sandra Hüller will win for one movie that she's in, and then another movie she's in will win Palme d'Or. Sandra Hüller was in Tony Erdmann a few years ago, another big Cannes breakout.
I was just going to say, we know her name from something else major at Cannes, right?
Yeah. The minute you see her face, you remember her from Tony Erdmann. Like, she's so recognizable.
Yeah. We just should be careful to remember that the juries are different each year. It's a different round of people, you know, slate of people. So predicting what's going to win is often a fool's errand, especially because as it tends to break down, the thing you are convinced is going to win very rarely actually does.
Well, let's talk more about Zone of Interest, because that's definitely one I was interested to hear about. I read your review, Richard, and it sounds maybe physically painful to watch, which is an interesting for predicting its success. Bessel David's ready to be a masochist. Richard, do you just want to talk more about what you talked about in your review?
Yeah, so it's a very loose adaptation of the recently late Martin Amis's novel. And Jonathan Glazer, in adapting the film, which he did, I guess, really over the course of a decade, lots of research and whatnot, he swapped out Amis's fictional characters for real people. And so we're really focused on Rudolf Haas and his family. Rudolf Haas was the longest serving commandant of Auschwitz. He was there when the Final Solution was really put into play, especially with Jews coming from Hungary. So he oversaw personally the death of, you know, by some estimates, 2 million people. So a horrible man, and with a family that was at best, just kind of passively complicit in this. And that's who the film is about. The film, we go into the actual camp once, very briefly, and we only have the only shot is of Rudolph's face. So we don't see any prisoners, we don't see any barracks, anything like that. Instead, we mostly spend time in their house across the wall, with a lovely garden and a swimming pool and a little barking dog and cute kids and a visit from, you know, from grandma. And we hear some sounds in the distance of what we assume to be horrible things. We see a smokestack billowing smoke and flame. We see ash raining down into the yard. So we know what's happening, but Glazer really keeps us trained on just the, I mean, I think every review of this movie used the term, the banality of evil. Mm. Just the everydayness of these people's lives, the way that they completely compartmentalized what was happening on their side of the wall and the other, which might seem sort of almost gimmicky, but in my view of it, it really works. I mean, I think in not showing you what we're used to seeing in movies like Schindler's List, but having the implication ever there, I think it really speaks to this current moment of our, you know, world and of our time. And we are watching a lot of people who have maybe gone from being deliberately, provocative on 4chan, making jokes about Jewish people. And now all of a sudden that ideology has become apparent in elected Congress people. And I think that to focus on those people, the bad actors or the people who passively abet it, is probably a good tack to take at this current juncture. And I think that the movie definitely has contemporary politics on its mind.
So, Rebecca, it sounds like you had a tougher time. And I guess I don't blame you based on how this sounds.
No, I mean, I found the film very unsettling. And it, you know, my question is always, did this film accomplish what it set out to do and make me feel what it wanted to? And yes, it did. And I think everyone should see it. My mistake was reading up about the book before I went in. And I said, oh, the book's about a love triangle. How interesting. And then I waited in this movie for a love triangle that never appeared. And so I think I had an expectation problem, which obviously other people will not have now that reviews are out and people can read about it. But I mean, the filmmaking is very bold. There's a choice he makes that uses sort of like, what is it, Richard? Night vision or infrared filming?
Yeah, kind of night vision, black and white night vision.
Yeah, that I it didn't quite work for me. You know, it kind of took me out of the film a little bit more than what I've liked. But I still thought about it the entire rest of the night, the entire next day. It definitely accomplishes what it sets out to do. So I don't think it's a bad film. I think I had a sort of a poor experience because of what I went in expecting. So everyone can learn from my mistake. It is not about a love triangle.
No, it's not. That little aspect of the book is basically only briefly hinted at in one scene.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's much more. So I guess Glazer, when filming it in this house, and a lot of it was filmed actually on the grounds of what's left of Auschwitz. He set up cameras in the house and then he left. And so the actors are just kind of walking around. And so you very much feel like a fly on the wall. I believe Stephanie Zakarik, in her Time review, compared it to like being a little mouse crouching in a corner watching these people. Mm. And it's really effective. I mean, it's a very structuralist, like high form movie, you know? And, I think that if we're talking about like, okay, what is this movie going to do throughout the rest of the season? It's coming out in December. A24 is releasing it on a raft of, you know, incredibly strong reviews for the most part. I wonder what the appeal will be, because it is a miserable sit and you have Michael Levy's score just really reminding you that we are dwelling in hell, you know, and or at least right next door to hell. It's punishing. I think it's really effective and a sort of necessary jolt to the system. But I don't know if its lack of sentimentality, which as brutal as Schindler's List is, there is that sort of powerfully moving point, you know, ending in the real people putting stones on his grave and title cards talking about how many people he saved and thus how many grandchildren he let, you know, exist in the world, essentially. This movie has none of that. And I wonder if that might prove to, not to be cynical, but art house for the Academy.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like something that is best discussed outside of its Oscar chances, maybe, which, you know, we're capable of doing that.
That never exists. That doesn't exist, Katie. Nothing.
Not here. Not in this podcast.
Well, Cannes is always interesting for that, though, right?
Like, yeah.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead, David.
I do, from what I've read, I mean, I have not seen the movie, but when you see the kinds of reviews that it's getting, you know, as a consensus, it's pretty undeniable as at least a contender for nominations. And I do think of late, the Academy has proven pretty willing to go out on a bit more of a limb for really acclaimed art house titles, at least with the branches for nominations, and then they just don't give them any wins. So sight unseen, that would be my prediction right now.
I think that Glazer and director, that feels like something that could happen here at Cannes, could certainly happen in terms of a direct Academy nomination. I mean, you know, this is a guy who has only made 4 films, and yet is sort of installed as one of the greats of the sort of international art house. You know, Birth was probably the one of his that didn't get a lot of love on its first run, and you know, and then has become a cult classic since. But Sexy Beast prior to that, Under the Skin after that, and now Zone of Interest, like, this guy is pretty much 4 for 4. Yeah. And he, you know, like Todd Field before, he takes his time. He's deliberate. These movies are years apart. Like, I think that the directing branch certainly would appreciate that.
And it does feel like lately there's been a slot for sort of one international filmmaker that he would easily fit into that slot.
Is he American?
Right?
He's British, but the movie's all in German.
You could also, I think, compare it to like a Ruben Östlund situation.
Mm. Just, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah, Triangle of Sadness being kind of honorary international feature. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
Okay, Rebecca, what have you loved?
May December is definitely my favorite film. I saw it the next morning after Zone of Interest, and you know, I didn't really know much about what the tone would be. This is the Todd Haynes film that stars Natalie Portman as a actress who goes to a small town to study the subject of her next film, who's played by Julianne Moore, who is a woman who had a scandal in her. I don't know how much did you say in your review, Richard? I feel like I can say.
Yeah, I mentioned a specific real life name that it seems to be borrowing from.
Oh, I thought that was like knowledge, right?
Was it knowledge before we sat in that it was inspired by that?
I mean, the title of the movie kind of tells you what kind of relationship's at the center of it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yes, it's a woman who had a sexual relationship with a boy who was in seventh grade. And now they are the young man is now 36 and they're still married and have kids. And so Natalie Portman's character goes to sort of study them. And there's a moment very early on in the film that just tells you what the tone is going to be, and you laugh, or I laughed, and just the way he handles tone and every choice he makes in this film, I just really, really loved it. The performances are really incredible. Charles Melton plays the young man in the film, and I think he, you know, he's from Riverdale. I don't think anyone knew if he could stand, you know, side to side with Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman. But his role, I think, is extremely difficult, and he really pulls it off. And I just left the movie so happy because I think it was just such a bold and interesting film. So that was by far my favorite.
It's a real high wire act to make a movie with that central premise funny, you know, because it's a terrible thing what happened. You know, it was terrible when Mary Kay Letourneau did it in real life. It's terrible when Gracie does it did it in this movie. She's the Julianne Moore character. But somehow it doesn't feel queasy. It's not making light of what happened. It's making light of them now, or Julianne Moore now, and it's making light of Hollywood sort of preying on these real life stories to make movies out of, make TV shows out of, make podcasts out of. But it's not didactic about that either. It's just a weird, campy thing that, you know, in different ways, both Portman and Moore are perfectly suited for this kind of thing. Julianne Moore has her soap opera past. Natalie Portman of late, I think, has kind of reinvented herself as this, like, I do big performances actor, you know?
So it's like a Vox Lux kind of thing?
It's more of a, it's a little Vox Lux, I guess, a little bit of Lucy in the Sky, you know, just kind of, but she's a lot slyer and shrewder than that character in this movie. You know, some great monologues. Like, it's just, the music is sort of very old school and pulpy and, well, that and erotic thriller. It's just like, it's perfectly pitched for Portman and Moore. Like, these are the two actors that I can think of, both of whom have, or no, I guess just Moore has worked with Todd Haynes in the past,
right.
But But they just, I don't know, they're a perfect fit for it. And then, yeah, you have Melton, who's like, oh, geez, good luck, kid. Like, that's tough. But he really does pull it off, and he becomes the sort of heart of the film, as he should be, you know, as the sort of victim at the center of this. It's just, it's again, it's a really tricky line to walk, and I think they somehow manage it really well.
Yeah, I interviewed Natalie Portman and Todd Haynes here in Cannes, and Natalie is the one who actually brought on Todd Haynes and thought, like, no other director is going to be able to deliver the tone here. And I think that was really a very smart move. And then obviously Todd brought on Julianne Moore, since they have such a long working relationship together. So it just feels like there could have been one misstep that made this film really not work. And that's why I really find it so impressive.
So this one has been picked up by Netflix for a decent amount of money. So I think talking about its Oscar chances is more appropriate than maybe for the Zone of Interest, which I think is really exciting. Like, I feel like a Todd Haynes awards moment is really overdue. You know, Carol had its challenges in terms of awards recognition. He's like been here before, but I'm really intrigued by the possibilities here for all three of the actors, as well as Todd Haynes.
Yeah. Makes me happy to see him get that kind of investment in a campaign. I mean, the last time he really had a significant contender was with the Weinstein Company. Yeah. So it's nice to see, a studio like Netflix that, you know, goes to Cannes to invest in awards contenders really put their might behind a filmmaker who hasn't always gotten the fairest shake in that regard. So regardless of what happens, that made me smile.
Not to make you and David and Katie jealous, but before this recording, Rebecca and I had lunch together in the little windy hill streets of the old town of Cannes.
Well, of course you did.
And she's a lot more sanguine about its awards chances. My fear is that it's too campy, it's too weird, it's a little too risque for the Academy. But Rebecca, you feel differently.
Yeah, I sort of compared it, and I was actually talking to buyers after I saw it, because they were also all wondering about its awards chances. And I compared it sort of as like Carol crossed with Tar, because I think the Academy obviously appreciated Tar's tone and moments of weirdness and humor. And so I think that they're going to appreciate this more than, you know, maybe Richard is anticipating, or I would have thought a few years ago. The performances are undeniable. It's an actor playing an actor, which I think they'll just eat up, because I also love that stuff. And Natalie has certain moments where they're just like stunning performance moments. So I feel like, you know, as long as the campaign is done right, and we know Netflix can really support a campaign, we're going to see it, I would think, at least acting and screenplay, if not more. I hope people can see it in theaters, because I really like those moments where you realize the audience is also feeling those campy moments with you. You know, that is a sort of a rare experience these days, I think. So, you know, I hope there will be some screenings, at least for press and other people, to experience it with an audience.
We got very lucky, because there's really only one screening of the movie where you don't know that it's a comedy. And that was ours.
Yeah.
You know, because now the word's out. And they did a good job of keeping that quiet, you know.
Yeah.
But yes, I do agree. I think that even if you know ahead of time that there's going to be a comedic element to it, the way that it establishes that very early on is worth kind of discovering with other people.
Yeah. You're all making me very nervous about a repeat of 2010, where Natalie Portman and Annette Bening were nominated for Best Actress against each other. And Netflix also has Naiad, the Annette Bening biopic, coming out later this fall, that I think some of us are already hoping is finally Annette Bening's chance to win an Oscar. Also, Julianne Moore was in The Kid All Right with Annette Bening. So everyone is all back under the same roof now. The 2010
Where's Hilary Swank is the real question.
She's coming up. Just watch out.
My hunch is they would run Julianne in supporting. Even though I don't know if that would maybe be a little bit
cheating. Well, that's what
they
did in 2010, Richard, and Natalie Portman went home with the Oscars. So are we going to deny Annette Bening once again?
Well, I don't know. Netflix is going to have to sort that out.
do I have a chip on my shoulder?
You've already got your little map with all your red lines on your wall, don't you? I can tell.
Cut to an ad, and Katie's like, this week's episode is brought to you by Annette Bening.
just personally. I mean, well, this is maybe a topic for closer to the fall festivals, but the crowdedness of Netflix's slate is certainly something we can get to talking about. We've all got our eye on Maestro coming up. There's a lot of other things in the hopper there. We'll see how they manage to balance it all.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Richard, lead off with another movie.
Well, one movie, a big movie premiering tonight, another American film that I was shocked to like was Asteroid City from Wes Anderson. I have not liked one of his movies in a long time, maybe since Moonrise Kingdom. And even then, nothing on par with like how I felt about Tenenbaums or whatever. And from the trailer, Asteroid City seemed to be, oh, okay, here we go, another. It's so presentational. It's a little curio. It's just quirky to the point of, you know, inhumanity. But something about Asteroid City and sort of this tone, and I think it's kind of about the pandemic and isolation, or being stuck somewhere and all that. Like, it really got me. When I saw it, I felt like I was going to cry for, like, half the movie, which is not a feeling I've had about his movies in a long time. The cast is great. They're all going to be at the premiere minus one person, I think. So that'll be a great red carpet moment that will have passed by the time this episode airs. But I was very pleasantly surprised to not just not be annoyed by a Wes Anderson movie in 2023, but to really, like, genuinely embrace it and to feel moved by it.
I've been really excited for Asteroid City, but it's also been hard for those of us just watching the trailers, like, to figure out who is the star and who's really going to pop in it. Who stood out for you?
I mean, Jason Schwartzman is maybe the first among equals, I guess you could say. He plays a recent widower who has, as the start of the film, has not told his kids that their mother has died yet. So that's obviously something to grab onto, but it really is an ensemble piece. But the great thing is that everyone gets their due. You know, everyone that I can think of in the cast, like, has a nice moment, either of comedy or something a little more melancholy. Tom Hanks plays Jason Schwartzman's father-in-law really well. Hope Davis and Liev Schreiber kind of pop by as other parents on this basically gifted students convention. Tilda Swinton is a kind of nerdy scientist. Margot Robbie, who I think is the one person not attending the premiere this tonight, she has this lovely monologue late in the film. There's a meta conceit to the movie where it's a television show about a play, and then most of the movie that we see is that play kind of filmed. It's weird. So Margot Robbie has a monologue in sort of one of the middle layers of that meta-ness. She's really great. So even though it's a very populated film, you worry that, oh, well, they're just going to have this X, you know, actor X show up with nothing to do. But I think everyone does have at least a moment, which I appreciated.
I know that David has a close eye on Hope Davis in particular, our always great captain. So
our always great captain. Well, there was a clip that was released of Scarlett Johansson and Hope Davis. And every headline was like introducing Scarlett Johansson, but Hope Davis completely stole the clip. So anyway.
Yeah, that's a great scene. Scarlett Johansson is really good throughout. She and Schwartzman have a flirtation in the movie. And this is just me probably being too like undergraduate about it, but like most of their flirtation, if not all, is him sitting in the window of his little cabin and her sitting in the window of hers and looking at each other across the little alleyway. And I'm like, oh, is this Zoom Windows?
That sounds Zoomy to me.
Yeah, a metaphor for talking over a computer. She's great. She and Schwartzman should do something else together. They have really good chemistry. But yeah, that Hope Davis scene she's pretty great.
I'm warmer towards Wes Anderson. I think we were all a little cold on French Dispatch, but it feels like it's his sweet spot. So I'm really glad to hear you liked it, Richard. And I kind of can't wait for it. I'm seeing it. I will have seen it by the time this episode is out as well.
And it's out in June, so all of us get to see it relatively
soon.
Yeah,
it's out soon.
Which is a nice feeling.
I'm seeing it in an hour. Richard, awards? What do you think?
I mean,
I love Richard : awards. Yeah. The theme of this episode.
I don't think I'm going to get any awards for it. Probably not, no. I don't know. It is in competition. Is Ruben Östlund someone who's going to be really swayed by Wes Anderson's, you know, 12th or whatever film? I don't know. I think there is definitely flashier stuff here. This is just kind of nice and star-studded and a kind of nice palate cleanser. I mean, in some ways, the way that May December was for After Zone of Interest, you know, like I think that that balance is important to have at Cannes. But there's not an actor I think they could be able to kind of grab onto. Yeah.
What about those other awards?
Heard of them?
Those big ones. Start with an O.
Richard, did you predict Asteroid City in our year ahead, or did you just do that with French Dispatch like twice? Because
no, he did. I did
Asteroid City. Yeah. No, I think that's a below the line thing for sure. You know, maybe a Best Picture, but it doesn't have the. While I found it very emotional in subtle ways, I think that, you know, Tenenbaums or whatever, like that has like a direct, like that is about difficult dad and then he dies, you know, at the end of the movie.
Spoiler.
And that's, sorry, 20 years later. That is like pretty easy to sort of grab onto. This is more of decidedly a Wes Anderson curio. The difference between this and French Dispatch, for me anyway, is that this offered something to connect with. It feels more outward facing than Dispatch, which felt very much like a one for him kind of thing. Mm. And so maybe the Academy will feel warmer to it than they did the French Dispatch, but I see that more in terms of its really beautiful production design and whatnot, but maybe not any of the big categories.
All right, well, I'm going to go Oscar-y again for the movie that I don't know when I'll get to see, and I'm going to lose my mind between now and then, but you guys have seen Killers of the Flower Moon. Rebecca, you got to talk to Lily Gladstone, who to me is the toast of Cannes, but actually it seems like not just me. Like, she is getting justifiably celebrated at Cannes.
Yeah, it's not just you. I thought she is phenomenal in this film. You can't take your eyes off her. Should I say what it's about first? Yes, this is Martin Scorsese's film based on a true story, based on David Grand's book about a Native American tribe called the Osage that became very wealthy from the oil on their land and then began to sort of be mysteriously and brutally killed, and sort of finding out, you know, who has been behind that. The book, I think, sort of unfolds very differently than the film when it comes to that aspect of the story. But, you know, Lily Gladstone plays one of the Osage women who marries a white man who's played by Leonardo DiCaprio. And this character is really stoic, but also like witty at times. And it's a really tough performance. And she plays it with such confidence. And there's a part of the film where her character is not in it as much in the second half. And I missed her, you know, I wanted her to be on screen more. So it was really wonderful to sit down with her. She is, a really interesting interview because she gives you really, really long answer. You know, she's not giving you a little soundbite. She is thoughtfully answering your questions. And I really enjoyed talking to her, and especially about the way she used her own family history, being raised on a reservation, to inform this character and what her own grandmother sort of had in common with this character. So I'm excited for her. You know, obviously a Native American actor has never won an Oscar. There have been a couple nominations, but the representation for that group in Hollywood has been so horrible that I'm really excited to see, you know, how this film does and goes as it goes into release and more people get to see it.
Can I pitch a reunited on the air for Kelly Reichardt and Lily Gladstone?
Yes, you can.
I'm here for it.
Yeah, at one point, Lily said, I don't watch a lot of award shows. I was like, you might have to start watching award shows.
Yeah, when you have a conversation like that with someone who hasn't been through the Oscar circuit, you're just like, okay, I hope you're ready. Like, I hope you've got some comfortable shoes and you're ready to do this.
Just get rest now. It's going to be quite an experience. But obviously, we're also talking about, you know, another incredible performance from Leo, and the filmmaking is so beautiful. I really enjoyed the first half more than the second. I've run into some people who say the opposite. I think when you're talking about a 3.5 hour movie,
I was about to say.
You can't, like, you're not, it's impossible to like all of it, but you know, I thought he did some really interesting storytelling choices that I also really appreciated.
I really noticed DiCaprio popping in a lot of reactions and reviews, which kind of feels like an actor we take for granted a little bit at this point, or that maybe just doesn't get those kinds of notices, because I also thought he was really excellent in Don't Look Up, but I'm not sure where you guys think he falls on the Oscar scale.
I mean, he's really good. You know, he and De Niro are villains, though, you know?
Yeah.
And they're a complaint, the most common complaint other than the length, which I like a long movie, but this really feels long, is that the movie spends a lot of time on the bad guys and not enough time on the Osage women and men who were the ones being, you know, victimized by all this. There are certain unfortunate realities that kind of partly explain that. People are bedridden, you know, poisoned, not very lucid.
Killed, yeah.
Killed, dead. But it is a tricky kind of math that the movie does, where we're spending a lot of time with the bad guys. And will that sort of frustration with the structure of the film detract from the really good performances of that villainy? I don't know. But, you know, DiCaprio is still just so magnetic, even though he's playing a vile person. Like, he just knows how to hold the camera. And he and Scorsese, obviously, in particular, know how to work together, ditto De Niro. And, yeah, so I think they're sort of definitely strong people in the mix. It's just a matter of how they want to kind of frame that, you know, what kind of campaigning do you do? These are not hero roles by any means, but they are the biggest roles in the movie. So that'll be a tough one for Apple to figure out. I was saying to Rebecca at our fabulous French lunch that you guys weren't at, Katie and David.
So I've heard.
That, you know, Apple, last time they had big Oscar success, they had the benefit of a kind of unexpected, heartwarming, crowd pleaser, sleeper thing, you know, and there wasn't a ton that they had to do to make that movie's case that the movie and its cast wasn't making already.
Yeah.
This is a trickier, almost the complete opposite type of thing. Granted, you have big movie stars, but those movie stars are playing murderers and part of a, you know, a sort of genocide. And so that's, I don't know how you market that. And you don't use the coda method, yeah. I'll tell you that.
Well, and we all remember how the Oscars treated The Irishman, where they give it, you know, 12 nominations and zero awards. Like, we're in a place where Scorsese also is getting taken for granted, which is crazy because of what he's given to cinema.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, is how does it compare for you guys to a movie like The Irishman, which similar length, I want to say similar critical reaction, strong performances, but yeah, to Katie's point, not only wound up going 0 for 12, but like it was a foregone conclusion at that Oscars that it was not going to win anything.
Yeah. This movie is better than The Irishman, I think. I don't know if you agree, okay, Richard.
That's notable.
It's, and I think you have this breakout star who is from the community that, you know, this movie should be raising up, and it would put a lot on Lily's shoulders, I think. But I hope whatever else happens that, you know, she is seriously considered and she can speak so eloquently. I mean, there's so many amazing native performers in this movie that really deliver. It's sort of like when we were watching Flower Drum Song or any of these things where you're like, look at all this talent. Like, I just can't wait to see where it goes from here, because they really deliver in a lot of different ways. But yeah, it is a tricky one, and they're going to have to navigate it carefully. So, but to me, it's very clearly part of the conversation is just, we're not into the sort of drama and backlash season yet. So I think they'll have
In terms of a potential backlash, they thus far have gotten a lot of words of approval from the Osage Nation, from tribal leaders. They apparently, in reworking the focus of the book and then one version of the script, they really like worked hard to involve more Native people, especially Osage people, on camera, behind the camera, working in various production roles, consulting to make sure they were doing it right. And it seems thus far that has paid off. But, you know, this is a very contentious issue, a real horror of Native American experience being told by a lot of white people, and not exclusively white people, certainly. But, like, you know, I think that's going to be a sensitivity that they have to manage for many more months now.
I love what Scorsese said in his Dublin interview that he did about kind of reframing Westerns. Like, he knows more about movies than maybe anyone alive. And, you know, talking about, like, the legacy of Howard Hawks and John Ford's Westerns and how his film is answering to that. Like, I think the more he can talk about that, and, like, even though he is an old white man, like, his ability to reframe these stories of the West and put a different focus on it, I think there's a real power in that.
Huh. Yeah, I remember the way he talked about Power of the Dog a couple of years ago. He presented Campion with something, and it's a theme he's clearly been thinking about pretty actively.
Yeah, I forgot about the Power of the Dog connection. Okay, we should wrap it up. Can continues onward, but Richard and Rebecca, anything else you want to highlight before we go?
Well, we both nearly got crushed to death trying to see Strange Way of Life, which is Almodovar's film that had like an insane crowd control issue.
Yeah, it's guys got in and the president of the Academy didn't, so congratulations.
I had to like basically pretend I was in John Cameron Mitchell's entourage to get in, but I made it. It's fine.
What did that look like?
I cannot even explain it to you, but... you know, it's a short film. They're going to be, I think, releasing it in the fall. It'll be in the shorts race. I really enjoyed watching it. It's really well made. It stars Pedro Pascal and Ethan Hawke. So, I think we'll be seeing much more of that when it comes to when we're talking awards race. And now that we've risked our lives for it, I really hope we're talking about it again.
They have a standby line this year for some public screenings. And I guess it's a nice idea in practice that like, oh, if there are no shows of people with tickets, you can just get in. But that led to like hundreds of people hoping to get in and waiting in line for 4.5 hours in the pouring rain to see a half hour movie. so that felt kind of bad. But I just want the full version of that short for sure.
A full version, to be clear, but Almodovar has kind of teased that he might make one.
Yeah. Well, no, I think he said it then. But like, I don't know. I like where the short's headed, but it didn't feel like enough of a meal as is. But it did allow Almodovar to bring 4 Spanish hunks to Cannes, which was always appreciated.
Yeah. Should we talk? I mean, the hunks have been like the everywhere you turn. I keep hearing about the hunks.
Yeah. They were at our party, or at least one of them was. Manu Rios, who's from Elise, the beloved Spanish teen soap opera. He's barely in the short, but just in the beginning. But it was just kind of fun to have early in the festival sort of a precedent setting like that. We also had that same day was the Correia film Monster, which, you know, provided my good cry of the year of the festival. I kind of wish they'd held it for later because I want to have that big cathartic, the trip's almost over cry rather than the trip's is just starting cry. But it's a really lovely movie, very much in his humanist fashion. People, you know him from Shoplifters and other things. My review's out there if people want to read it. I don't want to say too much about how the film is structured because it does kind of give stuff away. But it is part of a film canon, I think, that I did not expect it to be. Let's say that. And about certain issues perhaps germane to David and myself. Particularly. And I really appreciated that it was done so sensitively and in a way unique to that filmmaker. And that's one of the fun things of Cannes is being like, yeah, you want to see the new people, you want the unexpected stuff, but to check in with these, you know, mainstay stalwart Cannes directors like Correia and have them, you know, remain in top form.
That does it for this week's show. Next week, we'll be back. Richard and Rebecca will be back in North America. And we'll be kicking off our June Pride flashback series. You might remember this from last year. We have picked 5 movies this year because there are 5 Thursdays in June. And we really hope you watch along with us. I'm going to go through the list of what we'll be watching with the dates and where you can find them. We'll be kicking off on our June 1st episode with 1932's Shanghai Express, starring Marlena Dietrich and Anna May Wong. It's on the Criterion channel. You can watch it there. On June 8th, we will have Kiss of the Spider-Woman from 1985, starring William Hurt. You can rent that on various platforms of your choosing. June 15th, we'll have My Beautiful Laundrette with Daniel Day-Lewis from 1985. That is available on HBO Max and also rentable. June 22nd, 1998's Gods and Monsters, starring Ian McKellen and Brendan Fraser, recent Best Actor winner. That is available on Paramount Plus and elsewhere. And then, speaking of Todd Haynes, we'll wrap up on June 29th with 2002's Far From Heaven. That is on Stars and Rentable. You can see Todd Haynes and Julianne Moore together in that one before May-December opens later this year. We hope you watch along with us. It's going to be a great miniseries. In the meantime, find us at Vanity Fair. Find Richard and Rebecca's excellent can coverage there. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at VF Awards Insider and on our own. I am at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylaws, and check out the can live blog too.
Oh, yeah. The live blog has had Richard and Rebecca's dispatches, like little bits of things that don't make it into stories, fashion, party insight, all kinds of stuff. It's been really fun. David, where are you?
David Canfield, 97.
And Rebecca.
Rebecca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for how to prepare for when these Cannes movies finally make it to a theater near you goes to Rebecca Ford.
Just get rest now. It's going to be quite an experience.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR. From PR.